We're going to reach the end of the hearing. Just like you go away.
Thank you.
We have most of the day dedicated to your time.
Yes, we do. Which is quite luxurious. I've got the full team here. So there are myself and five officers to go through. So hopefully we will use that time productively. There's a lot of content for the panel to get familiar with. I'll kick off with the opening submissions, which were provided yesterday. And in the middle of them, I've also ended up some supplementary submissions that I'll go through as well. But I just want to check whether or not, as you may not have had the opportunity to pre-read them, just in terms of how much familiarity you've got with what I've tabled.
I've pre-read them.
Thank you. Which is understandable. Yeah, so I just needed to gauge the level of familiarity. So I will talk through them. I won't belabor every point, and I'll try and highlight what I'd like to ensure that you understand before we move on to the evidence. The first thing to understand, which we in part explained in hearing stream one as well, so this is a lot for Commissioner Coombs and Norden's benefit, is the relationship between the submitters that we're representing today. So there are six that are formally presenting in this hearing stream. Derby Planning Limited put in an umbrella submission, and all of the submitters here today rely on that submission, as do some other submitters in a more general sense, and that they're detailed in the Spurgs as evidence. And then the five specific submissions that are represented today are site-specific in respect of particular operations. So there's the Soho ski area, which is over the hill from the Catrona ski area. Triple Cone Investments, which is obviously the Triple Cone ski area. Lake Hayes Limited, which is a rural lifestyle block, currently zoned rural lifestyle block near Speargrass Flat. Lake Hayes Cellar Limited, which is otherwise known as Amersfield. And Mount Christina Limited, which is a rural residential block, currently zoned rural residential up the Northy Way. So it's those five particular site-specific operations that these submissions are in respect of, but they all rely on the Derby Planning Limited umbrella submission as well. In paragraph 1.4, I note that the interests represented by these submissions are wide-ranging, from ski fields through to rural living, through to the boutique commercial development in a rural setting. But the underlying principle for each of these entities' interests in the district plan is the same. The district's rural areas have significant potential to be used for a wide range of activities while still retaining their very important landscape, character and amenity values. Amersfield, Triple Cone and Soho represent existing nodes of development within the rural zone. And it is efficient and very beneficial in terms of positive effects for the district to ensure that use of these existing nodes of development can be further diversified, developed and optimised. And that's that theme of we're talking about existing operations, they're part of the existing environment, they are resources under Section 5, they have to be sustainably managed at the moment. And the ongoing development of them and optimisation of the use is, in my submission, an efficient use of those existing physical resources. The other key theme that underlie our submissions is this issue of diversification of use of the rural land. And Mr. Ferguson will in part touch on one of the operative RPS provisions, which is really key to this point. I just want to sort of remind you of it now. So it's the RPS policy 5.5.4, which is in Mr. Ferguson's appendix 1, which requires that councils must promote the diversification and use of Otago's land resource to achieve sustainable land use and management systems for future generations. And it's that active requirement of promotion of diversification that you'll hear echoes of the themes of throughout these submissions. It's not a passive enabling or a passive allowing, it's an active promotion of diversification. So it's the use of those two key terms in the operative RPS that is of particular relevance, I think, to the theme of these, I believe, these submissions this evening.
Is that policy requiring territorial authorities to do that on a district-wide basis or a site-by-site basis?
It doesn't specify what's the word for that, a size thing.
So if you looked at it district-wide, there is a diversification of land uses that are promoted in the district, aren't there?
Well, that's the debate that we're having.
Well, yeah. We go from convention centres just up the hill.
Right, I see what you mean. So within different
airports.
Or yes, out from urban compared to rural compared to.
Yes,
right.
It's the entire district.
You could argue that.
I don't think the regional policy statement is focused on the rural zone when it made that policy.
No, that's correct. It's not zone specific or character specific. Mm. Yeah.
And I'm just signalling to Mr. Ferguson now that you can tell us whether it's similar policy transferred through into the proposed.
Yes.
Yep. But again, this is what I said to you on Monday, we're placing less emphasis on the proposed because it's such a moving target. Mm. So what is there now could be quite different in September or whenever it is they just make this. So that goes to just wait, as you know, and we'll be able to address that when a decision does issue from the Regional Council. No doubt. Now, the legal submissions and evidence of the submitted entities also adopt and rely on the evidence that we presented in the first hearing stream. We're particularly relevant, we will repeat it, for the benefit of the new commissioners and councillor. And this repetition is needed, and when I get to the procedural issues section of the legal submissions, I'll explain the issue that necessity for repetition raises and a solution. So chapter 21, the existing and the future environments. There's a general theme addressed by the submitters in respect of the rural zone that to recognise and provide the value of rural land as a resource which enables a broad range of activities other than farming, and it includes conservation, recreation activities, tourism, employment and rural living. And within the zone there already exists a wide variety of land types and associated activities. And in my submission, it's the duty of the hearing panel to recognise and provide for those variations in land use and activity in planning for future generations of the district. The submitters are not opposed to farming being recognised and permitted, obviously, but the way in which farming is currently given preference over other activities, which are rural-based, within the higher order of the objectives of Chapter 21, may have unintended consequences on other desirable activities to be carried out in the rural zones in the future. And the starting point for considering this is what is the existing environment? So I've set out there the definition of environment in Section 2, which you'll be familiar with. And then I run through some case law on the concept of environment. It includes the past environment, as described in the relevant district plan, and the reasonably foreseeable environment. The future component of the environment is well established in the leading Court of Appeal case, Hawthorne State. Where in the context of a decision on a resource consent, the Court of Appeal analysed the scheme and the purpose of the RMA. You can see out there a quote which I suspect you're quite familiar with. Most recently, Far North District Council in Te Runanga Iwi and Ngāti Kapu, the Court of Appeal confirmed that in its plain meaning and in its context, we are satisfied that the environment necessarily imports a degree of futurity. Although the above authorities are in the context of resource consent applications, the concept of futurity in the existing environment has also been considered in the plan change application. This is the High Court consideration, Shorover Park. Now, it was a slightly different context in that case because they were considering whether or not the consents granted in respect of the Foodstuff supermarket, which was subject to appeal, should be considered in the context of Plan Change 19 as part of the existing environment. So there are comments in the High Court about the relevance of existing consents, but the argument was about likelihood of implementation given that they were subject to appeal. So it's not directly on point, but it is of assistance. And that Justice Fogarty confirmed again, not so much in Obert's comments, but as he made his way through the reasoning, that existing consents that are likely to be implemented are part of the existing environment that decision makers on the plan have to take into account.
So you're suggesting that we should be familiar with all the consents granted in the district
to understand the existing environment
that are likely to be implemented.
Yes.
And that zoning should follow that.
No, I'm not saying zoning should follow that. I'm saying the when you first consider what is the environment.
So we can consider what is the environment and say, well, there's been some ad hoc errors made in the past. We're not going to perpetuate that by zoning for that in the future. Is that a fair summary of things that we can do?
If that meets the purpose of the Act and gives effect to the higher order objectives and policies. But what these submissions are trying to help you with is your first assessment, one of your first assessments, one of your first fact-finding exercises, is what is the environment? So paragraph 2.10, I submit that unless there is substantive evidence establishing that the existing use of the rural zone is predominantly agricultural, and justifying that the future use of the rural zone should be similarly restricted to being predominantly agricultural production, then planning provisions providing for that outcome are inconsistent with the purpose of the Act and the case law interpreting that purpose.
Well, on that point, do we do that on an area basis?
Do you do that on an area basis?
Well, you said rural zone predominantly agricultural.
Well, I'm reflecting what the theme of the notified plan
is. And you're saying your submission is that should not be the focus.
Correct.
So if it's not going to be the focus, how should we approach that? Should we consider the area of the district, the district which is zone rural, that part of the zone which is set aside for conservation purposes, that part which is set aside for agriculture, and that part which is used for other tourism related, of which there are a diverse range of interests. Is that how we should do it?
To determine the character of the environment.
Well, to determine which is predominant.
Do you need to determine which is predominant? I guess that's a question you would have to ask yourself.
Well, are we to be, or should the plan pick something which is of diverse and wide range of character potential with a wide, broad range of unknown possible activity types, which is called tourism, and say that generally should be allowed anywhere in the rural zone, because that seems to be the thrust of your submissions overall. And a number of other parties.
Mm. Well, you're moving ahead of me here, because at the moment I'm still talking about establishing, being clear on what the existing environment is, what is its character, what does it currently support and look like, and what do people do here. That's the existing environment, which is starting point.
Okay, we'll go back to that. The existing environment, we know, because we've had the figures calculated, there is something like 45% of the rural zone is not conservation land and is outstanding natural landscape. Now, out of that 45%, there are 5 ski fields and very little else. The remaining 4% of the district, it's less than 4%, is divided between the urban areas, the rural residential, the rural lifestyle, and the rural land in Gippsland, and the rural land, which is not outstanding natural landscape. If you look at it in that sense, how is it possible to not say that the predominant use in the rural zone is agriculture? it must be something over 45%.
I think it's the high proportion of what other people would call rural living, use of rural land rather than strictly agricultural production.
But
that
the rural
uses that check.
But that is only going to occur. I mean, and it's the entire focus of most people wanting submissions in this particular stream. The floor of the Wakatipu Basin. The floor of the Wakatipu Basin, I doubt that it makes 2% of the district. I haven't done the figures, no one has presented it to us what the area is. But it is actually a very minor part of the district, isn't it?
Well, yeah, I can't concede that off on my feet.
Because you're a lawyer and I don't expect you to be able to do those medical calculations.
That's right. And I mean, this has been an interesting conversation because our focus, like I said, we haven't got a client interest in the rural general zone. We've got a rural living interest, a rural residential interest, and ski field interests.
Yes.
And so that's where our submissions are coming from, is making sure that the provisions reflect the existing environment in respect of those interests and moving forward, set up a framework.
But the rural living zone does not say that it is predominantly agricultural, does it?
No.
No.
That's correct. Yeah.
So there are really only the ski fields and Ennis Field.
Yes, in Ennis Field, yeah.
That are zoned rural, is that correct?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, the obvious group, that's right.
Yes.
That's right. Yeah. Yes. So we're on the same page. So I think our interests, in terms of you referred to other submitters, our interests are quite different to those other submitters who are more trapped, if you like, in that rural general classification, and then they're concerned about how that's affecting them. That is not where these submitters' interests are, and what their concerns are you know, distinct and different from those more general concerns that other people have. So I'll carry on. We do touch on in 2.12 that the landscape evidence of Dr. Reed for this hearing stream does not assess the landscape character of the district's rural zones as being characterised by farming, but the planning evidence of the council does state that farming is the predominant and long-standing land use. So there's a tension there still between what evidence the planner can rely upon when forming their conclusions to try and assist the panel.
From the summation I've just given you of the percentage areas, I would have thought that the planner was just speaking with Bodger.
And percentage, well, like I say, I'm not going to do maths on that feet and argue with you about numbers, because I don't think that's going to help anybody. 2.15, I talk about planning framework playing an important role in determining the appropriateness of activity, and this is now looking forwards. And the significance of activity's effects in the future. The planning context and the environmental context are both important considerations, and therefore it's important to get it right at this stage of the review by applying provisions which first protect the environment in the context of sustainable management. And then confirm that the amendments proposed by Mr. Ferguson reflect those submissions. So for the ski area subzones first, our overall approach is to ensure that the district plan provides for the maintenance and enhancement of the natural environment, landscape and amenity values that the ski fields rely on, while also recognising and providing for the significant positive effects to be derived from the use and development of those resources for commercial recreation and ancillary activities. The ski areas aim to continue to increase their significant economic contribution to the district by continuing to develop and diversify services on the mountain, not only during winter but year-round. And such improvements also contemplate improvement in access to the mountain, visitor accommodation, and many other commercial services on the mountain. Many of the changes in the latest version of Council's amended chapter do reflect the relief sought by the submitters, and those amendments are supported. And we just think that some further amendments are still required to provide for a more accurate definition of ski area subzone activities, and that's primarily to provide certainty for the for ski area developers. We need to provide better for transportation connections and passenger lift systems in order to ensure that ski area subzones are efficiently integrated with the district's planning roading network. And that's about future-proofing the options in the future to connect ski areas with the roads.
Can we... Is the expectation that we continue to get a plethora of these awful roads cut up the mountainsides, or is the intention to have something rather more fitting the natural environment?
The intention is to keep the options open. So
the best outcome to be achieved should the plan actually specify something better than what's happened in the past.
It's open to the panel.
Including the road that's just been put up to the Soho ski field.
Sorry?
Including the road that's just been put up to the Soho ski field.
Well, it's open, the plan can set the controls and the parameters around the effects of those future activities. But the framework that we're trying to propose, we're trying to ensure that there is, at the moment, there's no connection in a planning sense between the ski area subzones and the roading network that they've got to connect to. We're putting up sort of two options to address that. One will be addressed in the rezoning round, and we'll go through that in a lot of detail then again. But the other is through rules in this round. But we're not promoting one method or another right now, because depending on technology and cost and efficiencies and so on, we don't know right now what the best method will be in 10 years of connecting a ski area to the roading network. Because there's only a certain amount of prediction you can do in terms of where technologies go and the efficiencies and the economies of things. So
If you took existing technologies that are used around the world, where would gravel roads fit into that if you were to rate them in terms of effect on the environment, 1 to 10?
Well, I'm not an expert on landscape or roads or transport to ski fields, I do get a sort of crossy here, and we've also got Ms. Fluger to talk about the landscape effect. So I do encourage you to put those sorts of questions to them so that you can understand how transportation connections to ski fields are evolving around the world, what the issues are, what issues there are currently for ones that don't rely on roads, whether or not you always need road access regardless of whether or not you've got an alternative, lift system. Those are basically exactly the sort of questions that Mr. Frost will be able to help you with.
Well, that would be useful. What I'm just trying to get a handle on, though, is whether what we're seeking is something in the plan that would give preference to better outcomes than we've had in the past. Or are you just putting something in the plan that makes it easier to get what we've had in the past?
It's not the latter.
Right. So we're hoping it's the former.
We're hoping it's the former, but I have to it's a good question to ask.
So the
first
thing
well.
Is, yeah. So that's the intention. Right?
Yes,
that's what I'm trying to get a handle on.
Right.
How to
improve things in every sense. Yeah, yeah. And that, while we're on that topic, that goes the same for the introduction of the concept of visitor accommodation in the ski area subzones. I do get to this in my submissions as well. And we like the framework that's recommended by the 42A report writer in terms of a restricted discretionary rule. But what we want to add to that rule is a new measure of discretion that does give the council the discretion to require positive actions in respect of, and this is back to the offset compensation concept we were talking about on Monday, a new measure of discretion that requires positive actions in respect of landscape protection, positive actions in respect of ecological protection. Sometimes they take them with management plans, but the way that we worded it doesn't restrict you to just using management plans. It could be other ways of getting those positive benefits on the mountain. So that's what we've proposed as a package, and Mr. Ferguson will detail it more for the visitor accommodation role, on that thing that you were asking about. Right. So, turning over the page. So, for ski area subzone activities, and again, this is about future-proofing, business security, you know, just knowing what you can and can't do so that you, the ski area operators can plan their operations. So, we're seeking quite a detailed list to provide that certainty. And given the breadth of activities that could take place as an essential part of a ski area development, we consider it's important that these are spelled out so that in the future there is no doubt that they are appropriate. Transportation connection and passenger lift systems. I think we've covered that off probably in detail now.
Should we just amend where you just said, in general, be enabled? Do you want to retain that, or do you want to add what you just said previously, which was about better outcomes, hopefully?
Yeah, I mean, we're not saying they're permitted activities, so it is still a consenting process,
right,
that they need to go through.
Okay.
It's not part of that. Yeah. So there's a control that the council retains control over that controls outcomes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Which is what you're looking for, I think. You're just looking for the controls on the outcomes. Yeah.
I mean, I have to be fair about this. I drive over the Crown Lane frequently, so I get to see these things on the hillsides. And I've also travelled in Europe quite extensively, so I understand the alternatives that are available.
Yes.
I'm familiar with the options.
Yes, yeah.
And gravel roads do seem to me to be at the bottom end of the range.
Yes, but I think what will be helpful for you to understand is operationally what role does a road play, as well as, you know, in combination with those other alternative access routes.
Mm.
Operationally, there are issues that can't be...
I understand that.
Yes. Yeah. And then finally, on the concept of visitor accommodation, it's proposed in respect of accommodation on the mountains, we further refined the planning proposals, the rules in respect of that. The primary purpose for accommodation is visitor accommodation and worker accommodation. And given the length of the ski season in particular, the duration of stay of workers could be up to 6 months. So an exemption to the standard rule for visitor accommodation in terms of length of stay is suggested by Mr. Ferguson to provide a set of provisions that will enable buildings for visitor and worker accommodation to be assessed as restricted discretionary activities.
I just wondered on this point, and it's something that Mr. Ferguson can probably think about, but he gives his evidence, as to whether, in fact, the accommodation in the ski area subzones on the mountain should be a different category from visitor accommodation, rather than having exemption identify that there is specific type of accommodation required on the ski areas that is a combination of worker and visitor, long term. It just seemed to me that if we keep adjusting general rules to provide exemptions, is actually not a sensible way to proceed, because then you can continue to add exemptions and it all becomes pointless.
Mm. So something like ski area accommodation?
Yes.
That is something we haven't thought about, but we can think about that. We didn't think about that. All right,
I'm happy to add the benefit of my experience to you.
And also whether with the 6 month provision, how does that work when from some ski field operators have been telling us that they want to run the ski field areas 12 months a year, so i.e. where there's no snow.
Mm.
So how do you address visitor accommodation and worker accommodation if it's only limited to 6 months?
Well, that's the individual's stay. So we chose the 6 months because you'll have to keep your workers there in the winter, who may want to live on the mountain for the winter, or ski visitors who want to recreate on the mountain for the winter and stay in the visitor accommodation. And 6 months is a sort of a rule of thumb, allows for that window of accommodation activity. That's not excluding that different set of visitors and different set of workers will be on the mountain in the non-winter season. So it's the sale
How do you police someone that's going to work with ski one season and then, I'm just going to stay on the mountain and live here while we're doing mountain biking and other things?
Well,
Someone could explain how that's going to work.
It's derived from the current 3-month restriction for visitor accommodation. That's what we were looking at. We were like, well, at the moment, visitor accommodation in the proposed district plan is accommodation that's for no longer than 3 months. So we looked at that and went, well, that doesn't work for a ski area because the ski season's longer than 3 months. So that's where the exemption.
So when we're considering this, we need to understand that there will be permanent visitor and worker accommodation there used all year round.
No, well, that's not what's envisaged. Again, Hamish might be able to, Mr. Prosty might be able to explain this better than I, as a ski area operator, in terms of the pattern of worker employment and the pattern of visitors who use the resources that they've got up there. So I encourage you to ask him questions on those lines.
Thank you.
And Mr. Ferguson. So paragraph 3.6, as I flagged, we're committed to ensure that such developments come hand in hand with positive landscape and ecological effects on site. And in this regard, additions have been suggested by Mr. Ferguson to the restricted discretionary rule. As noted in the transportation section, Treble Cone and Soho have sought extensions of their zones, and this will be addressed again in more detail in the hearing stream. And the primary reason for the zone expansion is to ensure that the transportation network is linked and integrated with the local road network. It's not intended to enable visitor accommodation below and disconnected from the traditional ski area, i.e. the snow line. And so, after considering that further, they have proposed an additional standard in Mr. Ferguson's evidence restricting visitor accommodation to above an altitude of 1,100 metres.
Is that... I certainly understand that the existing one could run and what's proposed at Soho at 1,100 might be right, but would that also be appropriate to call that because it's existing?
Again, we can talk about this in detail, Mr. McCrosty, you'll be able to explain why we chose 1,100, but as taking into account all of the ski areas.
Okay,
yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. In terms of landscape categories, and this goes back to an issue that we raised initially in the first hearing stream on Chapter 6, the Council's most recent track change version of the higher order provisions do not include the amendments sought by the submitters in hearing stream 1 to ensure that this area is
a... Just clarify that. My understanding that the Council, as in a Council who notified the plan,
yes,
have not presented a track change version because they haven't made any decisions yet. You have a track change version prepared by the council officers.
Yes, the council officers.
I just want to make that clear because lay people are having to come with that, and I certainly don't expect the professionals to make the same error.
So, the council officer has not yet come to a meeting of the minds with us on this particular issue, and he still recommends that Rule 6.4.1.3 read differently to what was notified, so we supported the notified version of 6.4.1.3, but as it's still currently recommended by Mr. Barr, it only excludes landscape assessment measures from application to the ski area subzones rather than the landscape categories. So that is still a matter of concern to us. The exclusion of the ski area subzones from the landscape categories generally was discussed in our further submission to the panel on 30 March. Those submissions are adopted in full, but I summarise them again for the benefit of the new panel members. The landscape provisions in Chapters 3 and 6 do not provide for individual recognition of the characteristics of ONFLs within the district, and what has occurred is this blanket regime, which is restrictive towards all development in all ONFLs to the same level, regardless of their individual attributes. If the Supreme Court's reasoning in King Salmon and the determination of what is inappropriate is considered within the context of what is sought to be protected, then clearly those characteristics, features and values must be more explicitly identified in the plan if such identification is to be of meaningful assistance. key characteristics and values of each ONFL were identified in the plan that would include, in some instances, the observance of non-natural aspects such as ski field buildings, ski lifts and access roads, which are all important parts of the landscape, existing parts of the landscape, and any future development should be assessed for appropriateness against those particular existing attributes. The significant elements of human modification in ski areas must detract from the naturalness of the adjacent landscapes and raises questions as to whether the ski area subzones could actually form part of a separate landscape. Moreover, even if the ski area subzones are considered to form part of the adjacent ONFL, despite their significant modification, those particular and unique characteristics of the ski area subzones should be explicitly recognised in the plan by way of references to the particular ONFL. So in my submission, the above matters must be taken into account when assessing the attributes and the naturalness of each zone, and when describing those values within the zone purpose, and when considering provisions proposed to provide for the effective and efficient transportation networks. Mr. Osborne's economic evidence considers the importance of tourism as a significant contributor to the economy of the district, and that industry relies heavily on the open canals of the district. His evidence, however, is not based upon landscape evidence, which identifies more clearly those inappropriate and conflicting activities. Moreover, that evidence appears in support primarily for the rural zone provisions, which are not relevant for the preservation of the ONFLs in the district. His evidence also fails to make an assessment as to the actual effects of tourism on ONFLs and ski fields. Amendment of the ski area subzone provisions, consistent with the comments above and in accordance with Mr. Ferguson's evidence, will adequately provide for the appropriate protection of ONFLs. And that approach will also provide for an effects-based and case-by-case assessment, as is envisaged under the RMA. Any future developments can provide for economic benefits and contribute to economic growth and employment. So moving on to touch briefly on Indigenous vegetation, and this is still in relation to the ski area subzones only. And this is where my supplementary submissions I'll address as well at the end of the first couple of pages that I'm reading. The submissions by SOHO and TC also seek exclusion of an exception to Rule 33.3.4 for Indigenous vegetation clearance on land managed under the Conservation Act in accordance with the CMS or concession, under the Land Act in accordance with the Recreation Permit, or the Reserves Act in accordance with the Reserve Management Strategy. And what my supplementary submissions do is expand on those particular statutory instruments.
So I'll save my question.
Get a better understanding of them. The SOHO ski area is located within a Crown pastoral lease and is subject to a recreation permit under the Land Act. And I also say, if you've got questions about how that actually works, ask Mr. McCrossy, to see if he is the one who can answer that sort of question. Please don't ask me. Where land is subject to the framework of such legislation, SOHO submitted that it is a duplication of process and therefore inefficient for the district plan to subject this land to further rules and potential consent processes when such matters have already been considered. SOHO seeks to exempt Indigenous vegetation clearance on its land for these reasons, and it has submitted that that's appropriate. And similarly, on Treble Cone, it's conservation land, and so the activities of Treble Cone are subject to a concession by way of a lease. In addressing these submissions, the 42A report recommends this relief be rejected because it would not result in Council fulfilling its function under Section 31 of the Act. However, there is also Section 74.2B of the Act, which states that the territorial authority shall have regard to any management plans and strategies prepared under other Acts.
I was just wondering which management strategy or plan we've been dealing with.
You wonder which one we have been dealing with?
No, we would be referring to those.
Well, there's the conservation management strategy.
Well, yes, I understand that, but yep. Under the Land Act?
Under the Land Act. Well, maybe I should go to my supplementary submissions. Should we? I'll just finish up these two paragraphs,
okay.
And then we'll take through the other detail.
Yep. All right.
And I also do note that Section 32 requires that other reasonably practical options for achieving objectives be identified, and one of those options is the use of these other statutory instruments that achieve similar purpose in terms of vegetation protection.
Ms. Pacquiao, just sorry to interrupt. In 4.2, where you talk about that under those, there's additional requirements under 75, 3 and 4, shall have regard to any of those management plans. How does that relate to vegetation clearance protection when that's recognised and provided for under, is it Section 6 matter?
Yeah, recognised and provided for, yes.
Yeah.
Well,
had regard to it, but over here it's supposed to recognise and provide for it. How do we
reconcile,
manage?
Yeah. Well, it's once you get a better understanding of what those other management plans and strategies under the Land Act, the Reserves Act and the Conservation Act can do, you can see that through those processes, the identification and protection of vegetation is recognised and provided for. So what we're saying is to avoid duplication of processes and authorisations, assessments and dealing with different people that doesn't achieve a better environmental outcome at the end of the day. Your duty to recognise and provide for significant indigenous vegetation can be fulfilled, the council's duty can be fulfilled by using these, referencing these alternative processes that are required anyway of the landowner.
The fact that it's specified as a function also of the under the Act, under 31, and also that we have to give effect to whatever the provisions in the RPS.
Yeah.
Yes.
That would still cover you still have to be satisfied that Council is undertaking its duty to and its function in respect of vegetation. But you can, my submission is that you can be satisfied that that duty will be given effect to and that that function will be undertaken by reliance on these alternative, they're not alternative processes, by reliance on these additional processes and these additional authorisations that land occupiers will need to go through as well.
Thank you.
You're at 4.4, right?
Yes, so I don't think that adds anything in particular. So what I'll do is I do note in 4.6, this is relevant, that the Mackenzie District is just one example of where they have used this approach, and the rule provides an exclusion from what would otherwise be the significant Indigenous vegetation clearance rule, where particular authorisations have been achieved under other statutes. That's not binding on you, but it is informative that this approach has been undertaken elsewhere. So if you turn please to the supplementary legal submissions, and we'll look at it in a little bit more detail. So I set out in paragraph 2 the relief that's proposed in respect of an exception. And what I do is I set out the different tests that those three statutes establish in a brief description of the process. And as I said, Mr. McCrossy has had actual experience with these processes and can tell you what it ends up requiring an occupier to do. So that you can understand what that means in terms of the council's duty for vegetation. So under conservation management strategies and concessions, as you know, the Conservation Act promotes conservation of New Zealand's natural and historic resources. Functions include the management of the conservation estate, conservation advocacy and education, and fostering the use of resources for recreation and tourism. The purpose of the CMS is to implement general policies and establish objectives for the integrated management of natural and historic resources, including the species managed by the department, for recreation, tourism and other conservation purposes. And then in some instances, the conservation management plan is also prepared to establish detailed objectives for the implementation of the CMS. Now those two statutory documents are prepared through a public statutory process completed consultation with iwi local authorities, conservation boards, it goes up the ranks to the Director General and the Minister of Conservation for approval. There are submissions, there are hearings, and then there's recommendations until the process is concluded. The CMS for Otago has recently completed its public consultation process and it's in its final review by the Conservation Authority. The CMS provides a detailed list of the threatened and at-risk Indigenous fauna present in Otago.
Not fauna, just fauna.
No, probably just flora and fauna, I think that's a typo, sorry. And then, when any commercial activity is to be undertaken on conservation land, a concession is required. And the process of obtaining a concession is not similar to a resource consent, including a requirement to provide a detailed assessment of environmental effects. Concessions will not be granted by the Minister of Conservation if the proposed activity is contrary to the provisions of the Act or the purpose for which the land concern is held. And the Minister may decline the application if there are no adequate or reasonable methods for remedying, avoiding or mitigating the adverse effects of the activity. And unlike the RMA, the Conservation Act is not subject to an overarching purpose statement. There is no balancing of positive economic effects against other adverse effects. The provisions of the Act are more focused than the enabling purpose of sustainable management under the RMA. For example, the Department's function under the Conservation Act includes to manage land for conservation purposes. Now, concessions and CMSs don't act in isolation, and in considering whether to grant a concession, a decision maker must consider the relevant CMS and whether it more appropriately covers the activity in question. A concession must be implemented in accordance with the CMS, and when preparing a CMS, regard must be had to existing concessions. So from the above, in my submission, it can be concluded that the process of obtaining permission to clear or modify Indigenous vegetation in accordance with the Conservation Act provisions is a thorough process which provides for a stronger bottom line and environmental protection than would be required under the RMA. Accordingly, the process should not be duplicated or frustrated by requiring that those permissions granted also be subject to the resource consent process. And the main reason I say it provides a stronger bottom line than the RMA is the absence of any ability for a decision maker under the Conservation Act to balance positive economic effects against what might be, the adverse effects on the ground. It's purely about the effect on the natural resources. It's quite a different test under the Conservation Act. It's a more protective test. For recreation permits under the Land Act, so this is relevant to SOMO, situation primarily. Recreation permit is granted under Section 66 of the Land Act for the purpose of use or occupation of pastoral lease or crown land for any commercial undertaking for recreation, which in the opinion of the Land Settlement Board may be properly undertaken on that land. An application for a permit goes through a public notification process. It must not be granted if the activity is incompatible with any water or soil conservation objectives relating to that land. The board has an open-ended discretion to apply conditions and terms on any permit granted. And so this test also sets a threshold for environmental protection and public participation. In addition, a permit is granted with the deemed condition that it will be exercised with all of the local authority rules, regulations and provisions of the RMA. And the above means that, again, there is no need to require a duplicate consent for the district plan for the same activity.
Does the environmental protection that's provided go only in relation to water and soil conservation objectives?
That is the specific reference in the Act.
And so the protection for conservation that's under the Conservation Act doesn't apply?
It's the opening discretion, and again, Mr. McCrossy has gone through this process, so we'll be able to tell you what actually happens on the ground when this type of activity is tested.
Do you think that we can accept that when the Crown has an act with reasonably open-ended discretion, like the Land Act, we can accept that they will treat applications in the same way that the council is required to treat them under the RMA?
No, they will treat them in accordance with the act that they're working with them.
So there is no guarantee that the Crown would consider it in the same way that an application under the RMA would have to be dealt with by the Council, and considering particularly the requirements of Section 5 and Section 6 and the obligations in relation to biodiversity in Section 31.
For the Land Act, no, there is no explicit requirement that goes to that level of detail.
So it's not really a duplication, is it?
Well, that's the concern. In reality, it is a duplication of the process.
But isn't
that
a duplication that any tenant or leaseholder has in respect of land or buildings that they lease? I mean, it's no different from someone who leases a building that is formerly a warehouse and needs consent to turn it into a dance studio. They probably need the agreement of the landowner, the building owner, at the same time. That's a duplication of process, but we wouldn't grant that exception, would we?
No, but that's different because that landowner, or that building owner, isn't exercising a statutory role.
But the statutory role of the Crown is clearly constrained by Parliament's Act as to how it is controlled, is it? It's related to water and soil conservation objectives, and frankly, those probably haven't altered since 1967, when that amendment was put in and the Water and Soil Conservation Act was passed. I may be wrong, but I don't see that the Land Act falls into the same category as the Conservation Act. I do understand the Conservation Act. We had a discussion with the Council, I think, at the opening, that we understood that duplication was probably improper and there should be a mechanism to deal with that. But I think that you will be struggling to convince me that the Crown acting under the Land Act is acting in a way that would achieve the outcomes of the RMA.
1948.
Yes, I suspect that was
some time ago.
Yeah, so I mean what my colleagues will be able to explain further to you is in reality that the detailed requirements of the permits that get issued through this process do give us the confidence to make these submissions to you, because they are robust and comprehensive in terms of the protections.
That may well be the case, but presumably that is a matter of practice by the Department, not a statutory requirement of the Land Act. And that matter of practice could be changed at any time. A change of minister, for instance, could change that matter of practice.
I'll consider those concerns in more detail. They're valid concerns, and you need to be satisfied yourself that the protections are there.
And
if there's something else I can give you to help you.
I'll carry on with the Reserves Act to save you the trouble of reading it out and tell you I have the same concerns,
okay.
Because it is not just the Crown that manages Reserve Land. Of course, the Council also manages Reserve Land. And the Council, in managing its reserve land, does not take account of the RMA. It acts as a landowner, granting leases and permits.
That's the purpose for which the reserves help.
Yes. And leaves the RMA consideration to the permit holder to deal with. And if we were to grant, provide a rule that provided that exception here, that would provide the exception generally on council owned reserve land, irrespective of whether the approach that a Department of Conservation may take with reserve land, in any respect, the department's constrained by the Conservation Act when that deals with matters under the Reserve Act, doesn't it?
Yes.
So, if it is reserve land administered by the department, then it is subject to the conservation management strategy. That, I can understand, could be unnecessary duplication. I'm not satisfied that just a bald Reserves Act is.
Okay, well, I won't say that because you really thought about it, and I think what I'll do is consider further as more information I can give you to help you get to the bottom of those different statutes. Now that I understand your questions.
Isn't the practical outcome for your client that if they have to prepare X reports and Y amount of material for under the Land Act, that same material could be lodged with the council for a consent application at the same time?
That's just one of the duplication issues. There's any land occupier that has get multiple authorities for similar but different things under similar but different acts faces decisions about what sequence do they do that in, do they do it all at once. If they get a permit from one authority that sets particular conditions, and then they get a subsequent resource, they have to get a subsequent resource consent, and there's a conflict between those provisions, how do they address that? So the duplication issue is not, the concern is not just about process, and it's not just about efficiency and so on. It's about the practical issue of having multiple sets of authorisations that say, that, you know, hypothetically similar things.
Isn't the answer potentially for your client to get a good management plan approved under the Resource Management Act, which sets out parameters that covers a long period of time, and then present that to the other departments rather than the other way around?
Like I say, those sequencing questions are always very complex for
gives the greater scope to have management plans approved with, rather than an individual consent each year for the work that's required, which may be required under other legislation.
Another alternative could be legislative amendment. It's probably not that.
Well, they're talking about that too, but they have to go very far in the caravel, unfortunately.
Probably another 50 or 60 years.
Yeah.
It hasn't reached the centenary yet.
All right, let's move on. Moving on to our issues in respect of the rural residential and the rural lifestyle provisions for Lake Hayes Limited, which is the rural lifestyle block, and Mount Christina, which is a rural residential block up to Lenorpe. We've sought some changes to Chapter 22 to remove unnecessary, what we say is unnecessary and unjustified restrictions on development that will allow for a more efficient use of these rural living areas. For example, visitor accommodation is thought to be changed to restrict discretionary, not non-compliant, and for the rural lifestyle area, supporting the density of one residential unit per 1 hectare on average, an average density. And our evidence that has assessed these changes supports the conclusion that neither of the changes would put at risk the rural character or visual amenity values of the rural living areas. And Mount Christina's site also needs a boundary change to better reflect the topography of the site, and we'll be addressing that in the rezoning hearing next year. And then there's the Emmersfield site, which is also in the rural residential area. And in the rezoning hearing stream, we're seeking that site be rezoned rural residential with a commercial overlay. The introduction of a commercial overlay to the maps also necessitates changes to objectives, policies and rules in this chapter, so that there's a logical connection between the overlay and the rest of the zone that needs to be considered in this hearing stream also, but that will be of necessity addressed in the rezoning stream
Wouldn't it be logical for, even though it requires objectives and policies, for that entire package to be dealt with in the mapping hearings, because the commercial overlay that has been sought, those objectives and policies are specifically for that, aren't they?
Well, they are, and that's one of the things that we've, in terms of the fact that each hearing panel will be different, and we don't know who will be sitting on the rezoning hearing panel. Our understanding is that this hearing stream is on the provisions in this chapter, these chapters. And so we have to address the provisions. That includes provisions that affect a rezoning proposal. We will have to repeat this again next year to the hearing panel, even if it's the same people, because we'll be explaining then more in more detail the justification for the commercial overlay and rezoning proposal.
I think perhaps if it assists, I explained how we see it occurring, that by the time we've heard all the text matters, we would provide for interim guidance, but not as a recommendation to the council, how the panel in total sees the text wording, and that should occur sometime before we start the hearing rules. I would have thought for us to make any conclusions on the objectives and policies you're seeking to include here would effectively be a predetermination of that, and I'd rather not have them before us to consider, because if we don't include them, you could treat that as predetermination, and if we do include them, it could be treated as predetermination. Do you understand?
I do. It might be cleaner.
And that's certainly the approach we've taken with the various others who want individual special zones, etc., but they will all be dealt with, the entire package,
yes,
in one cut.
I mean, my only concern, so are you suggesting to me that we not advance this at all in this hearing stream?
It seems to be logical.
Because my concern with that is that this panel, who will be writing the recommendations on this hearing stream, still need to understand how it fits the objectives and policies that contemplate the commercial overlay.
Because the panel who hears the commercial overlay will, if it's seeking to add something, then I don't see that that's an issue, unless there's a direct conflict. But I'm just concerned that if we start deliberating on half of your package now, you may feel aggrieved if we don't include them. You may get overexcited if we do include them.
I mean, we're all grappling with the same procedural challenge.
I don't see that an overlay is any different from a special zone. So, I mean, it's only called an overlay. It's a zone.
Well, it's an overlay, but it fits within the rural residential zone.
Using other bits of zones, but it's seeking to be rezoned rural residential,
yes,
and it's seeking to have some specific provisions related to Emmersfield. It strikes me that package probably should be heard upon complete package, not parts.
Well, and I'd like to just sort of take instructions on that point over the break, because it all still needs to fit together as a package, and that's where I'm concerned that this panel still needs to have an awareness of that, because of the wider objectives and policies that relate to what happens in the rural residential zone, there still needs to be an integration and be live there. So what I'd like to do is just understand what you're saying.
I think, to be fair, at the conclusion of all the mapping, all the commissioners would have the confidence to ensure that the overall recommendations are all agreed on. And so I think we will resolve anything at that point. But I don't think that it's necessary to hear that now, just because of the difficulties it might create.
Right, I understand why you're saying that. And in fact, this is the procedural matter I raised in the last section of my submissions, is trying to figure out a solution to, you know, to this issue that we're all grappling with in terms of that there are different
channels. I don't see that as such a big issue as you, and now that you've raised it, I'll address it now. Given that we only have the ability to make recommendations to the council, the only issue arises if there is evidence heard in one stream that might impinge on the outcome in another stream. If the second stream comes after the first stream, that evidence has been presented and is available to be considered, which is what you're suggesting with your submissions on stream one.
That's where it gets to the solution. Yep.
And I point out that in terms of that, we have a majority on this panel of people who sat on stream one, because I have a casting vote. Mm. So, not that I think it's an issue. I also think that, also propose that before any interim guidance on the text as agreed would be agreed by all the commissioners on the panel, who have sat on the panel, so that it was consistent and we will ensure consistency right across. So I don't see that there are the procedural difficulties that you suggest in that section of your submission.
It's not so much I agree that the difficulties aren't insurmountable, and that the process you've described gives me a lot of confidence that the interim guidance will be the result of a comprehensive, sort of integrated understanding of all the related panel members, which is the solution that I was just trying to make sure why it's important is that, and this is what you've obviously appreciated, is that the submitters need to understand that their evidence has been heard by the right people, and there's an inevitable feedback loop, you know, from hearing stream 3, hearing stream 4, back to hearing stream 1, that feeds back into what's in hearing stream 2. So it sounds like you've got a system in place to take into account that inevitable feedback loop that will be required,
and
that you've got a system that ensures that all of your panellists are familiar with the evidence that they need to be familiar with to make a decision.
And the fact that I'm chairing all the hearings in relation to the text means that there is at least one member who is there for everything, and I can ask that evidence be presented to the stream. There was, for instance, evidence presented by one submitter in stream one that I asked to be presented also on the table for this hearing. So we deal with it that way.
Yes, and that's good that you can deal with it moving forward.
Yes,
and the other challenge is the retrospective, when you go, Truman was there to actually hear that, and we heard it here in stream 3. Mm. So it's good to hear that you've got a system that does ensure that takes place. Because that's all we're trying to make sure, that there is that comprehensive, robust kind of assessment of evidence happening as well.
And just to assist your understanding, before we commence deliberating on this hearing stream, we will have the draft reports of the hearing panel in streams 1A and 1B.
Right.
So for us to read and understand, so that we can ensure our deliberations are consistent with the outcomes there.
Yeah.
That's why we have different people, so that we can keep
Keep
something working while we're doing the next stream.
Yes. Okay, well, that's what, I mean, based on all that, I'm not going to read it, address those parts of my submissions as you really want to, but I don't think we're going to get anywhere by me doing that because you've addressed the main concern that I've got. Great. And I'll pass it on to Mr. Goldsmith as well.
Yes, well, that will save me amazing as well.
It could do. I won't promise that. Neither do I.
I can cut them off of the past.
Because
Baker Galloway will have explained this to you.
But I will address you because I know that you are expecting me to on the issue of scope.
Yes.
And in response to Mr. Winchester's.
Yes, yes. I think probably from paragraph 7 and 12 is the bit that we've dealt with, so you can certainly take
that's
it
right,
to there.
Yes.
Yes.
So just from paragraph 7.1, we raised the issue of sort of the concept of collective scope in our hearing stream 1 submissions. The council's right to reply on hearing stream 1 addressed that. And I'll set out a quote from Mr. Winchester's submissions there. And what we found when we read those submissions was that they did seem to be contradictory and confused the different concepts of scope versus standing. Standing, as you know, is the right to submit, appeal, appear, or be heard, and it's quite different to what evidence is admissible and what is within the scope of relief. They're quite different things. Standing's not an issue here, given that all submitters and further submitters have made valid submissions and further submissions. And I've never advanced the issue of standing, but it was addressed in Mr. Winchester's reply. I am still of the view that the High Court case of Simon Sewell Summers Pass is applicable, and so I disagree with Mr. Winchester there. Schedule 1 is, he submitted that it wasn't applicable, and the Schedule 1 is a code in terms of standing, which is where we get confused again, the use of different terms. The reasoning and the principles set out in Simon Sewell case are resistance. And I acknowledge, I think in hearing stream 1, the Simon Sewell case is a reasonable consent decision, so we acknowledge that the concept of scope was being discussed in a different context. But the principle is still relevant to a plan, where the High Court said what is important is that the applicant is put on notice by submissions in their entirety of the issues sought to be raised so that they can be confronted by that consenting authority. And in coming to that conclusion, the High Court and Simons Hill relied explicitly on the Environment Court's determination on the scope in the context of plan changes. And it's like an EDS case, which was relied on, again, in our hearings stream 1. In my submission at 7.7, it cannot be said that Schedule 1 provides a code for scope, and that's assuming that Mr. Winchester actually intended to refer to this as scope rather than standing. Clause 8 provides a process for submitters to become involved in the plan change, therefore to establish standing. Schedule 1 does not provide any guidance or restrictions on the determination of admissible evidence or the weight to be given to that evidence. The principles of admissible evidence is that it must be probative and relevant. The evidence that meets both the relevance test and has probative value will be admitted. The evidence presented in the course of hearings on the plan, which supports any submission put to the panel, is fairly relevant. If it is fairly relevant and probative, it's your duty to inquire and make recommendations, to inquire and assess it and make recommendations in reliance on the evidence that you find to be probative and relevant. But the reality of council's lawyers' legal submissions would, for example, mean that a well-resourced submitter could not present expert evidence in respect to the matter contained in another person's submission. That might be highly relevant and of assistance to the panel, and that cannot be the outcome envisaged by Parliament, and it's not the outcome supported by case law. I therefore disagree with the contention in the legal submissions that the weight to be attributed to any evidence depends on whether that evidence relates to the relief specified in that particular submission. Evidence is either relevant and probative, or it is not. It's either admissible or it is not, and provided it's relevant and admissible, the weight to be given to the evidence does not relate to some theoretical extent to which evidence directly or indirectly relates to a piece of specific relief in a submission. Finally, a contextual reading of the whole of Schedule 1 makes clear the distinction between a hearing to be held on submissions and a planning instrument under Clause 8B and appeals to be brought under Clause 14. Clause 8B provides that a local authority must hold a hearing into submissions. It does not specify which submitters may be heard or upon what methods. By contrast, Clause 14 expressly provides that a person may only bring an appeal where they refer to the provision being appealed in their submission on the plan. Accordingly, the submissions and evidence presented for the submitters are within scope if they or any part of them meet the following tests. The relevant relief is specifically requested in a submission or further submission, any submission or further submission. The relevant relief is a consequential or alternative relief. And the relevant relief is within the scope of all submissions lodged. So, a long way of saying I haven't changed my position.
Yes. I think, in terms of evidence, is it fair to say that with expert evidence, we're entitled to rely upon their opinions on the basis that they are appearing to assist the hearing panel rather than a particular submitter or two?
Yes.
And consequently, the weight we give expert evidence presented to us should be really based on the degree to which that evidence is objective and well-founded. And the final question is if experts are proposing changes to the plan as notified, you accept that we would be better assisted and likely to give more weight to such evidence that includes a Section 32AA assessment. Or considers the factors that deals with that.
Yes, so...
A Section 32AA assessment is not a table full of facile words. It's actually a part of the robust and well-founded opinion that we need to expect. That's what I'm getting at.
Addressing the latter point, the Section 32AA further evaluation, that is for the planner to pull together and provide you with their expert opinion on the relevant matters from the other experts that feed into that further evaluation of cost and benefits and so on.
Yes, so
the planner,
I was thinking.
Yes, the planner. So yes to the 32AA, that's Ms. Ferguson's expertise, and that expert thought process has to be, expert reasoning process has to be, it assists if it's illustrated in his reasoning to support his conclusions.
So if we approach it, expert evidence on that basis, as long as the matters being dealt with by the expert are within the range of submissions before us, that is appropriate for us to receive.
That's my submission.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Now, that's right. Not as I understood it the first time round, but I'm happier now.
Good.
So, if that's the end of the submissions, would it be appropriate? We'll take the morning now, I think,
okay.
And you can take instructions on that matter to deal with Amos Field.
Okay.
And then we can proceed.
Yep. Thank you.
So we will adjourn until 11:35.
Thank you.